the inflation issue we suffer is slow and insidious. If you're in Venezuela, I mean, the two places I've been, I regularly talk about is Venezuela and Cambodia, where people want dollars. If you're in Venezuela, you know the Bolivar is dog shit. So you don't want it. You want the dollar because compared to that, it is a lot better. You have to understand better money. And you have to find a way to get access to it.
Welcome back to this episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. I am your host, Eric Rao. Today we have an awesome rip with the one and only Peter McCormick. Peter and I have a fun chat on a wide variety of topics, ranging from his start in podcasting to what it was like to interview a sitting president, why Bitcoin matters to people all around the world, how to take better care of your body and mind, and much more. This was a fun chat as we talked a lot about sports, life, Bitcoin, and everything in between. Thank you once again for joining, and I hope you enjoy the show. All right, welcome back to the 11th episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. Today I have podcast extraordinaire, presidential interviewer, the King of Bedford, recording here with the Prince of Portland, Peter McCormick. Welcome, Peter.
The Prince of Portland with the King of Bedford. Listen, I think I've broken your show title.
No. I'm still very clearly the dumbest in this room.
Dude, I am the dumbest guy in the room always. You know what? I was talking to you about it beforehand, but when I saw your show title, I was like, fuck, that's what I should have had. Then everyone would have known. I should have said the dumbest guy in the room. Honestly, I think that show title is a stroke of genius. So well done, mate. But thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate you being willing to jump on. I know you've had a pretty hectic last 2 months, or hectic, busy, good, you know, last 2 months. If you want to just, first of all, maybe tell the listeners about a little bit about who you are, and then we can maybe jump on, you know, kind of the awesome experiences you've got to have the last couple of months.
Yeah, sure. Sure, Eric. So my name's Peter McCormack. People will tell from my voice that I am from England. I live in a little shit town called Bedford. I love it. and I am an accidental podcaster. I didn't mean for this to be a career. Like, I just started a podcast, a bit like you. Like almost certainly exactly the same as you, coming up to nearly 4 years ago. I found this Bitcoin thing, and it was crypto for me as well at the same time. I found it really complicated and didn't understand it. And I was like, I kind of fancy doing a podcast. I'm just going to go and ask the questions I don't know the answers to. So I've ended up, having this podcast now that's done like 365 episodes. And I'm really sorry. My voice is really croaky because England played Germany last night in the Euros, and me and my son went to Wembley and we won 2-0, and we were screaming our heads off. So today I'm like, I sound pretty croaky.
Oh, no worries at all. I'm sure it looked like a great game to be at. You guys enjoy?
Dude, honestly, it was fucking epic because it's a lifetime of pain being an England supporter if you're my age. I wasn't alive in 1966 when we won the World Cup, and ever since then it's just been disappointment after disappointment, and lots of them, they just felt so close. I mean, I was too young. I think maybe it was the 82 World Cup where we were like 2-0 up against Germany and we lost 3-2. I could have that one wrong because I wasn't alive. My first one was the World Cup in 1990 when I was 12, and we got to the semi-finals. And we played Germany and we were one down. It was a really fluky goal. This guy took a free kick and it hit our defender and then looped over our goalie. But Gary Lineker came up and equalized with about 10 minutes ago and went through extra time into penalties. We lost in penalties. And it was just like, oh. But I was 12. I got over that quickly. But then in Euro 96, which is like the World Cup for Europe, it was hosted in England. We got to the semi-finals again. And again, we got Germany. We were the better team. That was the best team of my lifetime. That was Gazza as well, Lineker and Beardsley. It was a great team. We should have won that game. Went to penalties. And then we lost. And I'm pretty sure it's Gareth Southgate, who's our current manager, who missed the penalty. And then we've had so many tournaments we've lost on penalties or dodgy goals. We again lost to Germany 4-1 in the South Africa World Cup. So when we got them again, it's just like, oh, they're going to break our hearts again. And no, they didn't. We won 2-0. It was epic. It was epic. And to be there with my son, I feel really, really lucky. Like, to have that moment together was just really special. So, but I am very like croaky today, so I might have to keep coughing to try and get it out of me.
No worries at all. That sounds like an awesome experience, and you know, nice to see the win come out of it rather than the years of heartbreak leading up to it. So probably made it a little bit that much more special, even. So is soccer? I mean, I guess probably football over there is football your guys' go-to sport?
Yeah, it's I mean, it's this, cricket and rugby. They're the three sports, right? Football, cricket, and rugby. But football, we all love. Like, as a nation, we love it, and we torture ourselves with it. And there's just so many disappointments. Whereas, like cricket and rugby, we won the Rugby World Cup. When was that? I was about 25, 26. So that was about 14 years ago. So we won that. We just won the. I'm sure we just won the Cricket World Cup. Really lucky, and we won that with a fluke. The most unbelievable, you couldn't repeat again, fluke. But we won that. And, you know, through other sports, we've had our times. But with football, we haven't won a trophy in my lifetime. And I've watched Germany win probably four in my lifetime, maybe more, and Spain win three or four, and France win two or three. And it's like, why have we not won one? But we've got a chance now. You know, we've got, it's opened up for us to get to the final, right? So last year we got the semi-final of the World Cup against Croatia, and we lost sadly. The path has opened up for us because we've got Ukraine in the next round, who we should beat. Ukraine aren't great. They're all right, but they're not great. We should beat them. And then we've either got Denmark or the Czech Republic. Again, we should beat either of those, which means that'll get into the final. And that's likely a final against Belgium, Spain, or Italy, which would be tough. But we've got a route to the final. If we get to the final and we don't win, I'll be sad, but it'd be like, at least I've seen a final now.
With sports, though, anything can happen once you get there, especially with soccer. You know, it could be a 1-0 game, that closes out in the last couple minutes, and you could win it that way. So you don't, it's interesting. You don't always have to be the better team. You just got to be better for one day.
Dude, Switzerland just knocked France out. France were, I don't know if they were the favorites. They should have been the favorites. On paper, they had the best team. And they lost to Switzerland. And it was incredible. It was an incredible game. So anything can happen. We've got a chance. We're in there. We're in the mix. We're in the last eight teams. And if we win on Saturday, we're in the last four teams. And if we win our semi, we're in the final. So we've got a chance. And the thing is about these tournaments, mate, it's so funny, right? I love them. World Cup or the... Yeah, the European, the Euros, I'll watch every single game, loving it, enjoying every game. The minute England go out, I'm like, I don't care anymore. Fuck this. Fucking bullshit.
No interest.
I mean, as I've got older, less so. When I was like in my 20s, once England were gone, I did not care. I'd maybe watch the final reluctantly or a bit of a... I just didn't care. I've got a bit older. I still watch them. But when you're still in it, every game matters. Because that's a team you can play, right? And you're excited. Once you're out, you're like, this is just bullshit.
Just bitter at all the other teams. Makes total sense.
I don't cry anymore. I used to, honestly, I've actually cried in Euro 96 when I was 18. I was convinced we were going to win it because of our team and our manager, and it was in England, and we were better than Germany. And when we went out on penalties, I was so upset. I had to leave my mates and go call my dad, and I was crying. So, Dad, it's not fair. Fucking moron.
Well, I bet if you guys win it this year, maybe the tears will come back.
Hey, dude, I don't know, man. I don't know how. It's one of those weird things, though. Like, it's like I'm a Liverpool fan, and we hadn't won the league and since I was, God, 11 years old, maybe 30 odd years ago, and I've supported them through and through, just not won the league. And my son starts supporting them with me. We don't win the league. And then we win it. And we're like, oh, my God, we won it, jumping up and down. And I was like, oh, but what does it actually mean? Like, afterwards, I was like questioning myself, going, so how does life change now? Tomorrow I wake up and we're champions, but does it matter? Like, and I wonder if the same will happen with the Euros. Say we win it. And I'll be like jumping around and I'll have a load of fun that night celebrating. And then afterwards, you're like, why does any of this matter? Like, why do we care? Because when you think about it, it's like, why do you care? Why is it? I love watching football because I'm entertained by it, but why do you have to win the tournament? I don't know.
It's funny to think about it that way. You know, we've got the NBA playoffs going on right now, and everybody has a team they're rooting for. And so that's my sport. Basketball's what I love. And, you know, it's kind of the same thing. You're happy when a team succeeds, and then it's like, well, if they didn't, it doesn't change my life that much.
Who's Portland's team?
So Portland has the Trailblazers. I personally am not a big Trailblazer fan. I think our GM, his name is Neil Olshey, is terrible. and he has been forever. And I just don't like what he does with the team. And they have an absolute star named Damian Lillard, who I don't think he puts the right pieces around him. So my team, the team I cheer for is the Dallas Mavericks, because I love Luka Doncic. He's from over in Europe, and he's just really fun to watch. And so that's who my team is.
My son loves basketball. Like out here, I've got him one of those. I wonder if you can see it. Can you see out this window?
I think the sun's a little. Oh, there it is.
Can you see it?
Yep, there it is.
Just right there. Yeah, yeah. I've got him one of those. He loves it. He's quite tall. You look like you might be tall. My son's 6'2". I'm a fucking short ass, but he's 6'2", and he loves it so much. I ended up getting him one of those big, proper ones that stands up and you can wheel it around. I'm so shit, mate. I'm so rubbish. Do you play?
Yeah, I actually played in college a little bit.
Did you?
Real small college. Basketball is what I like to do. It's like kind of how I like to stay active and get, you know, I don't really like cardio, but if I'm playing basketball, it's okay.
How tall are you?
6'3",
damn. Jesus.
How about you?
Like 5'9" and a half.
Where's your son's height come from?
It's from his mum's side. His granddad is tall, and he was essentially a professional goalkeeper when he was younger, but back when there wasn't really a proper professional game. But he played to a really high standard. He would definitely be a championship player, potentially a Premier League player. Like he played to a high standard, but he's tall, and so my son's tall. My daughter's catching me up, and I'm going to be the midget of the family.
Hey, at least your kids get some height in there somewhere, and you know, can, if they like athletics, they can do that as well.
Yeah, of course, man. Look, I don't mind them being tall. It's just, yeah, I just wish I was taller.
Well, whenever I make it out to Bedford, I'll give you some shooting lessons on the hoop.
Dude, you can play my son. He'll play you one-on-one. He'll fancy his chances.
There we go. That'd be a good time.
Do you know what? I did get to shoot some hoops in Indianapolis. Oh. I was with Jack Mallers, and we got to go to the training center. Who's the Indianapolis team?
The Pacers.
Yeah, we went to the Pacers training place. Like, so we got a tour of the facilities, and then got to go out on the, where there's like, I think it's like two or three training courts. And I had about 80 shots, but I think I hit about 2 3-pointers, but I had one that was perfect, where I just flipped it right, then went straight in, didn't hit the rim, just went straight in, and I walked away. I was happy with that.
Yeah, you got to always end on a good note. It's actually ironic. Back in the day, I was working with a different company and helped build a basketball training facility out in Indianapolis as well. So that's a city that really loves its basketball. I've heard some crazy stories about their high school tournaments.
I like Indianapolis. I've been twice now. I like it. I like places like that. In some ways, it feels a little bit similar to Portland. In some ways, you know, there's good places for beer. Yeah, the people are friendly. It's not a major U.S. city. It's not like a L.A. or San Fran or New York. So it doesn't have an attitude. It doesn't have like, I like those places in the U.S.
Yeah, there's definitely some fun cities in the U.S. that are like a little bit, you know, like looked over, and, you know, you can have a great time there and just meet cool people. It's always a good time, you know, to find those spots. And like you said, just find a pub or something like that locally and enjoy some time with some people.
Good breweries, man. You have good breweries. I'll tell you where I had good breweries. I went to was Cleveland in Ohio.
Yeah. Interesting. I haven't been out there.
Yeah, it's cool, man. They've got some great breweries. I was trying to think when I went back there. I mean, that was like 2 years ago, but yeah, it's great.
Are you a IPA drinker? What's your drink of choice?
you know, I don't normally drink beer. I'm not a big beer drinker. I'm more of a wine or a whiskey or a gin. But if I go to a brewery, you know, where they kind of make it on site, I always like to get those flights where you get six different ones and try it. You know, more of like an experience. But if I'm drinking, it's whiskey, it's old fashions, whiskey sours, or red wine. They're my drinks. But I haven't drunk 10 days. I've had 10 days off there because when I travel, I tend to drink a lot more because there's social events. And so then I get home, I'm like, I need a break. I'm drinking for 6 weeks solid. It's just, my body's like, you fucking idiot, have a break.
I've been trying this new thing where like I have one drinking occasion per month. So like Okay. Whatever it might be one day or it might be like a weekend or something like that. So it's been kind of nice because you clear out your system for, you know, about 3 to 4 weeks at a time. Then you have a good time with your friends and you don't feel too bad about like, you know, drinking a little bit there. And because like we all know alcohol is not great for our bodies. So it's a nice way to kind of be still drinking and having a good time with friends. But at the same time, you're not like killing your stomach and stuff.
Dude, I know it. My problem is I can easily drink too much, right? So I can be away and I can drink every day and then just kind of every day want it. And then I get back and I'm like, stop. So it's kind of like extremes. I go feast or famine. I can stop for months on end. And sometimes I think maybe this is just something I don't want in my life. And then I get away and go for a nice meal. It's like, yeah, I'd like a glass of red wine with that, please.
Yeah, definitely. Right. It's always nice with a nice like steak and red wine. Anything like that is definitely nice. Nice way to go.
Yeah, man. But I'm off the drink right now, so that's good, man. Having a little break.
There you go. Reset the system. Reset. So you mentioned at the start that you were a quote unquote accidental podcaster. So yeah. How does that come to be? How did you get into podcasting? And you know what brought you to start a Bitcoin podcast in there?
Yeah, it's I mean, I've told the story a couple of times, but and it's just a weird chain of events. But where do I start with this? So back in 2013, I got married and then separated very quickly, and ended up with a bit of a drug problem, a bit of a drug addiction. I ended up going down the cocaine rabbit hole, which I had a lot of fun with, and then I stopped having fun with, and then it became awful and kind of had to clean myself up and get my shit together. And what happened was I knew about Bitcoin already because of the Silk Road, which is, yeah, a lot of people will know about as an open marketplace, like Amazon for drugs really. And when my mum had got sick, we wanted to treat her. So we ended up, you know, getting some Bitcoin and buying cannabis oil. And what happened was I kind of stayed in Bitcoin and I was trading Bitcoin and trading shit coins, etc. And I'd made a bit of money and I decided to get myself a new car. So I bought myself just not a brand new car, but like a secondhand Mercedes, a nice car. And I remember going into see one of my buddies, and he was like, oh, I said about the car, and he's like, oh, you should listen to podcasts because you can connect that to your car when you're driving around. I was like, oh, that's cool. So I ended up Googling top 10 podcasts, and I discovered this podcast by this guy called Rich Roll, who's based out in California. He's like a vegan super athlete. Yeah, does Ironman and all kinds of crazy shit. And so I was really enjoying his podcast, and I'd go out running, listen to it. And then I ended up Googling him to find out more. And I found out like a week later, he was about to host a running and yoga vegan retreat in Italy. And I was like, oh, fuck it. I think I need to go to this. So I went and had a great time, really enjoyed myself, got to know him. And he said, if you're ever in LA, look me up. And I was like, I'm just gonna come to LA. I want to hang out with you. You're cool. So I went out to LA, stayed in Topanga Canyon just to go running for a week on my own, just to clear my head, and then hung out with him a bit. And while I was there, I was just like, mate, I like your life. It seems really cool. You just like interview people and talk to people and get money for it. I love it. I want to do it. And he was like, well, look, this is how you do a podcast. He sent me the Pat Flynn course on launching a podcast and told me the equipment I needed. And I was staying Oh no, I'm confusing trips. That wasn't the Topanga Canyon one. This was a separate trip because I was staying at my friend Justin's. That's right. And so I ordered the equipment. I reached out to Luke Martin, who was in LA at the time. And I was like, Luke, I'm going to launch a podcast. Do you want to be the first guest? And he said, yes. So we recorded that. And then I went back to England, recorded another one. And then I flew out to Raleigh and interviewed Jameson Lopp. And then I came back and didn't do it for a couple of weeks. And then I was like, no, I think I want to do this and do this properly. So yeah, that was early. It's November 2017. I recorded the first show, but it was, I think it was around January 2018. I was like, I'm really going to go for this. But yeah, it was all by accident, dude. It was this weird chain of events whereby if I hadn't bought that car, maybe I wouldn't discover Rich's podcast. Or if I didn't discover Rich's podcast, I maybe wouldn't have gone to his retreat. Or if I didn't go to his retreat, maybe I didn't go out to LA and hang out with him. But this weird chain of events, and I ended up just doing this podcast, and now it's become, it's not a hobby anymore. It's a, you know, it's a business. It's got six people who work on it full time, and you know, it generates money and pays wages, and yeah, it's a business now.
It's wild how it can go from a spur of the moment decision to, you know, fly to Italy, and then another spur of the moment decision to fly to California, and then just develop into its whole own company. And it's basically a sustainable company where you can travel to interview people, and you can pay other people and build a whole life around it, as you know. And it's pretty cool lifestyle at the same time, where you can, you know, see the world and do all those cool things. So what was it about
Eric, I think one of the things I would say, like, I never want to like be too, yeah, talk about it too much in a way that might come across as like ego, but I definitely put myself in situations, like I've definitely put myself in places where I have the chance for these things to happen. So for example, I was like, I will go to this retreat, and when Rich said, if you're in LA, I just went to LA, you know, and I made sure I hung out with him. And that's carried all the way through what I've done. Like, so for example, you mentioned the interview with the president. I did go to El Salvador right at the start of that whole thing, and I kept in touch with that project. And then when the announcement happened, I was in New York, and I contacted them, and I said, look, I can come to El Salvador and do an interview next week and have it. So like, I'm always putting myself in the situations to have the chance for these things to happen. They don't always come off. You know, there's plenty of losses I've had, things I've wanted to get that I've missed out on. But I think if you're always putting yourself out there, you're always putting yourself in the position for luck to come your way, it generally does.
Yeah, there's two quotes that I love that kind of go right along with that. Is it's opportunities multiply as they're seized. And so, you know, you put yourself in position as to have these great opportunities, and they multiplied. And then the other one is, it's like, the more I practice, the luckier I get. And so, you know, in your situation... Yeah. In your situation, you quote unquote were practicing by, you know, traveling and doing all these things. And now you're starting to get other people call it luck, but they don't see the hours and hours and hours of hard work, or the hundreds of people that told you no at the beginning. And they don't see the other side of it. They just see the success. And it looks like luck to some people. It's like when Steph Curry shoots a half court shot and it goes in, it might look like luck to 99% of the world, but to Steph, he's practiced that shot thousands and thousands and thousands of times, so he feels confident when he can do that.
I think I've heard a slightly different version of that. It's the harder I work, the luckier I get. I think I heard that version, and you know, it's kind of true, and people don't see it. I even had one guy say to me once, he goes, like, your job is to press record and ask questions, that's it. I was like, mate, you got no fucking idea. It's way more than that. Like, I've actually studied people interviewing. I've sat and watched Rogan, I've sat and watched Howard Stern, literally watched them interview and trying to figure out what it is they do that allows them to create such engaging interviews. And I've tried to learn from that and trying to create my own style. I've traveled, you know, I've got on planes and gone to countries to get interviews that other people don't want to do. And sometimes they don't make sense. Yeah, it makes sense to fly to El Salvador and interview a president. You know, it might not make sense to fly to Santiago, Chile to see a riot, but you never know what comes from these things, and you just build your network and keep plugging away, keep working hard, and you know, think things will come your way. I was interviewed today by this kid. He was 21. He's just launched a podcast. He was like, oh, I've just left college, what advice can you give me? And I was like, look, the one thing I can say, because I'm not the smartest, I'm from a shit small town in England, but the one thing I know is like hard work. You cannot beat hard work. Like, people out there sometimes complain, and I would always look and go, you know, if you're not happy with your life, how hard are you working? Like, are you pissed off and doing a 9 to 5 and coming home and watching TV? Or you, because you can come home and then from 5 until bedtime, you can be learning something. You can be online, you can create, like, you can always try and better yourselves. But I think you just have to like work and grind out. And sometimes it's years after years. Like, I've worked my ass off for 20 years, mate, like nonstop. So yeah, sometimes I think hard work is really important.
I couldn't agree more. That's one thing I've noticed in this past year, you know, with all the lockdowns and everything going on, I really I felt like I was pretty stagnant previously. And, you know, I was working a different job before and I had ample amount of free time and I would just have sports podcasts playing and I would have, you know, just random noise Netflix TV shows playing in the background. And then, like, you know, last year I was like, why am I listening to sports when I could like start training my mind better? And started, and then I found like Preston Pish's podcast, and he talks about what you were talking about. He turned your car into a learning center or learning factory. And so I started doing that. I was only listening to podcasts and audiobooks in my car. And then next thing I know is when I was working out too. And then next thing I know is when I was on walks and when I was cooking and when I was in the shower, and I was like, just absorbing so much more information and learning at such a faster pace, because everything I was doing, I was learning rather than, I haven't listened to music in like 6 months. Like, unless I'm with friends, like my phone, I don't know when the last time I updated my playlist was or anything like that. It's okay, what's the new podcast? Who can I listen to try and learn and advance myself that way? And like you mentioned, like with podcasting, like, you don't just press record. When I first, you know, was thinking about starting it, I shot you an email. So I shot you and Daniel Prince an email, because you were two of the podcasts I listened to the most often, and two people I resonated with a lot in the podcasting space as, nice, you know, guys who might not know all the technicals of Bitcoin and how it exactly works, but put themselves out there to try and learn. And when I shot you guys the email, you both, like, out of nowhere in the email said, I'll be on your show. And I was like, they both just called my bluff. I have to capitalize on this and like make it happen. And unfortunately, you know, you and I, our scheduling got pushed out to now, but with Daniel, he was like, he's like, we can record next week. And I'm like, I need to buy a mic. I need to learn how to record. I need to do all this. And then I was like, right, it was like 2 days before, I was like, I've never interviewed anybody. And I was like,
that first one, dude, it's so sketchy, right? Isn't it?
Well, I was like, I've never even done an interview for a college paper or anything. So I called my buddy and I was like, dude, I just need to ask you questions and interview. And then I'm like taking notes and trying to like route the conversation in different ways. I was like, this is going to be so much harder than I ever expected. So it's been quite a learning curve over this past couple of months. It's it really goes to show like how much work, you know, you and Daniel and all these other podcasters in the space have really put in to, you know, create the process. And I'm like, just barely scratching the surface and feel like I've improved a little bit, but still have so far to go in there.
Dude, it's a nonstop journey of learning. And I always say to people, because a lot of people, like, I've had compliments to me. People like, oh, I love the podcasting, you're great, think you're a good interviewer, yada, yada. And I've also had people think I'm terrible and criticize me and whatever. And they're all fine. But one of the things I always say is that it is a job. So what I'm doing is a job, and I want to be the best I possibly can at it. So I do work on my interviewing skills. I do try and become better. I can't listen back. That's my one problem. I cannot listen back to any of them. So I haven't listened back to any of my interviews now in nearly 3 years. I just can't do it. I can't face it. But I'm a pretty good judge of how I'm doing during the interview, and also the feedback on the shows themselves. And you're always learning. Like, yeah, I'm pretty comfortable doing the Bitcoin interviews for now, but I did the Eric Weinstein one recently. And afterwards I thought, I'd fucking nailed that. I did really, really well. And I was reflecting on it the other day, and I think it's, in terms of my performance, one of my worst, because I didn't prep in the right way. I prepped to be able to answer Eric's criticisms of Bitcoin. And I've reflected on that. I said, why the fuck did I do that? I don't have to defend it. I'm an interviewer. I have to get him to get his points across. That's all I have to do. I don't have to defend Bitcoin. And what I didn't think through properly was that actually there's going to be two distinct groups of listeners on this. There's going to be Bitcoin people and Eric Weinstein fans, right? There's a third one, which is shitcoiners, who basically all wish he was interviewing with Charles Hoskinson and getting into Cardano, whatever, forget those. And what ends up happening is the Bitcoin people were mainly disappointed with Eric, and the Eric fans were mainly disappointed with me. And ultimately, that's my failure, because I think I can't change what the Bitcoin people think of Eric. They just have to get an impression of him based on the interview. What I can do is all these new people coming in, first discovering my show, I can, if I do the right job, they might go, oh, actually, I like that interview. I like that guy. I'll come back. Not everyone, but they might like that. And I fucked it up because I didn't think that through. And therefore, I was being combative and challenging towards Eric when actually I really should have just been trying to get him to talk. So I totally got that wrong, and I'm cool with that. But that's just part of the learning. That's like, okay, the next one of those interviews like that, I really need to think about the audience for that show. So it's just, like I say, you're always learning. You're always trying to improve. Not everyone, but I am. I've got ambitions. And I know to kind of reach my peak potential, I have to keep working on that. And look, my interviewing Bukele might be my peak. It might be all downhill from there. Or maybe I'll get something bigger one day, and I just have to make sure I'm prepped as best possible to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Excuse me. I think that's a great point. Is just doing the preparation the best that you can, so that you can be ready when the opportunity presents itself. That was an incredible interview that you were able to have with President Bukele down in El Salvador, and that's a pretty incredible opportunity. And maybe once in a lifetime, but maybe it's not. Mm. Maybe we see 12 countries later this year pass laws, and three of those countries say, hey, Peter McCormick has a big audience. We want to talk to him about what our country's doing. And then it turns into more that front where they're reaching out to you. But you're putting yourself in the right position. And, like we said, opportunities are going to multiply as they're seized. You seize an opportunity. You took the risk to fly directly to El Salvador from New York. I heard your story of, you delayed your trip. I think now maybe a good point. We could roll back a little, start with the whole El Salvador experience and then kind of go through the whole story. And it doesn't have to be the whole in-depth thing. But for the listeners, probably a lot of them haven't heard the story. So I think it'd be a good thing to jump into.
I mean, there's a lot to tell. So I'll tell bits and you can ask questions. But this started for me, I think it was December 2019. Le BitConf was on in Uruguay, and I was invited to go. So I went. Anyone can go to these events, and there were other Bitcoiners there. Jimmy Song was there, Max and Stacy were there, the same people I tend to see at all of them. And I went as well. I was one of the people that went. And I'm outside the hotel, and this guy, Michael Peterson, comes up to me with this Salvadoran called Jorge and his kid. And he's like, oh, hi, Pete. Yeah, just want to introduce myself. My name's Michael. I live out in El Salvador, and I'm working on a Bitcoin project. Would you like to know more about it? I was like, yeah. You got to remember, I get a lot of this, right? But it's like, yeah, fine. Yeah, tell me what is it about? And he said, well, basically I run a program to try and help keep kids out of gangs and trouble by giving them jobs in the community. And then we pay them in Bitcoin, and we've created the circular economy. And it's like, can I tell you more about it? And I was like, just give me a second. So I got my phone out, and I went on Momondo, and I was like, right, it's two flights from Uruguay. You go to Panama. I can't remember the flights, but just say they're 2-3 hour flights. It's one to Panama and Panama to El Salvador. And I was like, well, I kind of want to visit El Salvador. I like the chance to visit countries, right, that I've never been to. It's just a side point. Somebody once said to me, you should go to as many countries as your age. It's a good target. And then, if you live to 75 and you've visited 75 countries, that's a great thing. And then every year you're trying to do new countries. So I'm now ahead of my age. When I started this podcast, I was 37 and I'd done 25 countries, and now I'm 42 and I think I've done 44 countries. So it's really helped me with that. So I was like, yeah, I'll have another country on my list. So I looked it up and I was like, right, okay, I can be there in 2 days. He's like, oh, great. So I booked the flights, went out. He picked me up at the airport, went to Elzonte, and he showed me this project. And it was kind of cute. I mean, but it was nothing big. It was just, I went to this kind of house and we're in the yard and there were like 10 kids all playing football. And then he showed me them all getting paid in Lightning. And then he told me like a couple of places accept Bitcoin. One was a pupuseria. So we went up and got pupusas and I bought them. And I left thinking, yeah, that was cute. See you later. Like, it's cute. I didn't expect it. I didn't see it as some big thing. I just thought it was interesting and, you know, fair play to him for doing it. And then I go back to El Salvador in February, but that was only to go to the capital to interview somebody from my other podcast. And then go back to the UK, but I stay in touch with Michael and I see he does occasional interviews here or there. And, you know, COVID hits and we're in lockdown and we're getting towards, I want to say towards the end of last year, maybe it's the beginning of this year. And I'm aware that Jack Mallers is down there working on Strike. So I'm kind of aware like there's more opportunity. And then he gets in touch and says, oh, can we make another show? It'd be you, me, Jack Mallers and Miles Suter from Square. And I was like, yeah, cool, we'll do another one. And did an update and he's like, you got to get back out of here, man, the project's growing. I was like, oh, yeah, cool, it sounds cool, as soon as we're flying again I will. And then the Miami conference comes up and I'm asked to MC and I want to be there, but we have a restriction coming into the US due to COVID that we have to go somewhere else for 2 weeks first. So I was just looking, I was going to go to somewhere like Antigua. Then Jack reaches out and said, listen, we're going back to El Salvador, I want to make a film, do you want to come and do it? You've got to sign an NDA. And I'm like, yeah, cool, I've got to be somewhere anyway, I'll do it. So I sign the NDA, do a call, and he tells me, yeah, there's looks like the country might make Bitcoin legal tender. I was like, what? Fucking hell, man, that's massive. Okay, I need to get my head around this. So anyway, fly out to El Salvador and have 2 weeks there, film what Jack and his team are up to, catch up with Michael. But the project is so much bigger now. Like, Elzonte is 3,000 people, but almost every place is accepting Bitcoin now. And people also want Bitcoin and they know more about Bitcoin and they're talking about it. Like, this little seed has now just sprouted and is getting a little bit more interesting. It's still small, but it's getting more interesting. So anyway, hang out there for a couple of weeks, head out to Guatemala, go out to the US, go to LA, do the Weinstein interview, go to the Inti 500, get to Miami. Jack does his presentation. It's announced. It's like, wow. And I was due to fly back on the Sunday after the Monday after the conference, but I had the opportunity to go to New York and interview Michael Mallers, which is an interview I really wanted to do. So I'd got in touch with my ex-wife who was looking after the kids and said, look, I need to extend by 2 days, I've got to do this interview in New York. And she's like, fine. So I fly out to New York. Coincidentally, I've met this girl as well. I met this girl in Miami, and we'd hung out for a few days and I flew to New York, she flew back to Houston. I was like, dude, do you want to just come out to New York? And she was like, yeah. So she flew out to New York with me and we're hanging out. And then the whole bill thing comes out. It feels like it comes out of nowhere. And Nick Carter does his spaces, the brothers come on. I'm like, shit, this has happened, this is massive. I'm like, I think I need to try and get and do this interview, because if I go back to the UK and then getting back to a bit of a nightmare. So I reach out to the brothers on Twitter and I'm like, can we talk? I want to talk. And he's like, yeah, we can talk. So I have a phone call and I was like, listen, I want the interview, I'm going to give you my sales speech. I think I was the first journalist to go and cover this in El Salvador. Some people might disagree that I'm a journalist, but either way, I've been 4 times. I love the country, I love the people. You know, I have got one of the bigger Bitcoin podcasts, maybe the biggest. I know the story. Please have the interview. And he went, okay, I can't tell you what. Oh, no. He's like back and forth. He said, yeah, maybe I'll get back to you. I'm meant to be flying back to London. So I have to reach out. I reach out to my ex-wife and I'm like, listen, look, this interview's come up. It's with a present. I've got to do if it comes in, but I don't know. It's not confirmed yet. She's like, when will you know? Because I need to make plans. I was like, I don't know when I'll know, because, you know, I've got loose contact with them. But if I find out at any point up until before I get on that plane, I'm staying doing it. And she's like, okay. Kids are a bit pissed off. So anyway, so I reach out to the brother the night before and said, listen, I'm staying an extra day in New York, but I've got to fly back tomorrow. I need to know. Don't hear anything. And then on the day, about, we're talking like 4 hours before I meant to go to the airport, I text him and I'm like, right, last chance. I want to do it. If I can do it, let me know. But I've got to go and get my plane in 4 hours, like 2 hours before I'm due to leave. I get a text saying, listen, you can 100% have the interview, but I can't tell you what day it is. But if you come here next week, so straight in touch with my ex-wife, I'm like, I'm doing this interview. I'm not going to be back. Probably going to be another week. So I book the flight to El Salvador and off I go. And, you know, and as you know, I had a meeting with him. And then on the Friday, I did the interview, which was mind blowing. It just still cannot get my head around it all. It's massively overwhelming. Sorry, I'm rambling here, telling a long version of the story, but feel free to ask anything you want. But the whole thing is really overwhelming.
I can imagine how it would be. You know, went from a trip to film a video to flying around the country, seeing a bunch of cool things, or even a different country, not your own country, seeing a bunch of different cool things, and flying back to interview a sitting president who's just passed one of the most transformative laws of our lifetime. If not the most transformative law of our lifetime.
Think about it like this, Eric. I'm your 11th interview. My 11th interview, I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was Lynn Albrecht, whoever. I did my 11th interview, right? And I probably felt very similar to you feel right now. It's new. A few hundred, maybe a couple of thousand people will listen to a show. It's kind of a hobby. I'm not being paid for it, whatever. You, as much as I have, could in 3.5 years time be getting a plane somewhere to interview a president. It can happen to you just as much as it happened to me, because you're in exactly the same position as I am. And that's crazy when you think about it, that can happen. Yes, it's just really overwhelming. Sorry, I jumped in there, but all I'm saying is, mate, if it comes up, you might have that. If you do that, fuck you, man. This is my gig.
Maybe one day we'll be fighting for presidential interviews. And my sales pitch to them will be, I won't show up in a Metallica t-shirt.
Hey, man, they want the Metallica shirt. They'll be like, really? What are you going to wear, Pantera?
Man, the memes after that were pretty funny on Twitter. But I like that. Like, I like that he was like, yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, because like he's like, hey, I'm a regular guy. Like, let's have an interview and a conversation. Like, clothing doesn't matter. And like, I respect that about him a lot. And, you know, I don't know much about him. I don't know. You might know a bit more about him as an individual, but it seems like to me from this point, or at this point, he's doing things for the right reasons to try and help the people of his country. And that's all we can hope for in the Bitcoin community, to try and, you know, that's what we see Bitcoin doing.
Almost everybody has critics and supporters. So if you go into my YouTube comments for that interview, you've got people who are massively behind what he's doing, and you've got critics who are calling him an authoritarian and a dictator, and he's probably going to be a this or that. You can't get by in life without that. I have people who support my show, and I have critics. I don't know if you've hit the critics yet, but you will. It will can't happen, and that's just the way life is. Let's compare him to the last four presidents who stole hundreds of millions of dollars from El Salvador. One is in exile, hiding in Nicaragua, Turum jail, and one died. This guy's come in and he said, we've got enough money if we don't steal it. And yeah, I mean, look, he's strong-armed his way through a couple of things. You know, he did bring a couple of guys from the military into government to get a law passed. He did remove a bunch of judges and some other stuff. And there is stuff whereby maybe if you're the US government, you're thinking, oh, who's this guy? But he's also getting shit done. And yeah, so far, there's no reason to believe he is corrupt. It's like he said to me, he said, they call me an autocrat. I could have created a CBDC and made my own currency and controlled it. I don't want to do that. I now have two currencies in my country, which I don't control. So I believe he's doing it for the right reasons. Even if he isn't, like, he's still putting Bitcoin in the hands of a lot of people who wouldn't normally have it. And that's, you know, that's interesting. And he's also being the brave one to take the first step. I keep saying this comment, but he's essentially, El Salvador is the micro strategy of countries. They're the first one, and they get it right, they're ahead of everyone else. You know, there's a lot of Bitcoin people looking to invest in the country, a lot of Bitcoin companies looking to invest in the country. You know, this might turn out to be an absolute masterstroke by him, but I believe, based on my experience with him, his intentions are right, and I am cautiously optimistic, because I think that's how you have to be. Do you know what was it? You listened to the interview, right? Mm-hmm. I asked him why we should trust him, and I thought his answer was fucking brilliant. Like, should we trust him? So yeah, let's see how it plays out.
Yeah, it cautiously optimistic is, I think, a good point, especially in the Bitcoin community. It's, you know, you come in with like a low bar, because, you know, people have done stupid things in the past, and now mm-hmm. these people have to, you know, live up to whatever they say they're going to do. Otherwise, they're going to get like hammered by the Bitcoin community. And you know, we see so far Saylor's been good for the community, in my opinion. And hopefully, you know, Bukele continues to be good for the community. So it sounds like you got the impression that he was going to be a good actor for the community. What was it about him that made you think that?
Well, you know, firstly, he could have had anyone in for the interview. He could have had CNN, Fox News, New York Times. He could have had anyone, and he let me do it, a Bitcoin podcaster from Bedford. And I thought that's pretty cool. He explained it to me, you know, after the interview. I've got it on recorded, but I didn't release it. He was just like, he's saying I could have anyone in to do this, but they'll turn up and they'll ask boring questions. It'll be a boring interview. And he was kind of giving me the impression that I deserved it, which was really cool. He's really in touch with young people and modern life. He understands social media, right? He understands Bitcoin. He doesn't care about dressing up. He is something different, and he's a breath of fresh air. And as I say, I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't want to hang my hat on it in case if it turns bad, then I at least want to be able to say, like, that I didn't trust him unnecessarily. I do want to hold him to account, like everyone should with Elon Musk, like everyone should with Michael Saylor. But the way I had a private meeting with him, the way he talks about his country, his people, what he wants to do, the legacy he wants to leave, my belief is actually, you know, he's a good guy. But we have to see how this plays out. You know, he has one term. What happens after that term? You know, do they end up trying to get somebody in that suits his agenda? Does he try and change the constitution? I don't believe he will do that. But they're all things, they're all questions up in the air. I think we just have to wait and see. I can't change any of that. He's going to do what he's going to do. What I can do, though, is I can help people in El Salvador adopt Bitcoin and understand Bitcoin. That's all I can do. And so, as I said to him in the interview, like, I'm here to support and help the people of El Salvador. And I will do that. I'll go back and I'll help as and when I can.
That's wonderful. And, you know, hopefully they won't be the last. And I find it hard to believe that they would be the last country to do so. You know, they are the first, but I really don't see a situation where they're the only one that does it. So, you know, we're going to have, just as, you know, people supporting Bitcoin, we're going to have a lot of work to do in the coming months and years to help, you know, underprivileged countries to learn about it and help the people learn. Because one thing that I was actually just talking with Gigi on my last podcast about was everyone in the world doesn't need to understand Bitcoin to the fullest extent for it to succeed. But we need to be able to educate the people on how to use it for themselves, you know, properly, and to, you know, do the right mechanism so that they're not like being taken advantage of or losing their Bitcoin. And so I think that's a really powerful thought, because, you know, not everyone in El Salvador needs to do 10,000 hours of research to understand it and figure out what's actually going on behind the scenes. But it's just like, you know, we don't need to do 10,000 hours of research of what's going on behind our iPhone to understand what's going on, you know, between the touch screen and the apps and the internet. So I think it's really hopeful for the future of, you know, the world at the end of the day, and how powerful this can be.
We're not going to have 7 billion GGs on this planet, right?
Yeah.
You know,
we'd be lucky to have two GGs on this planet.
Yeah. we would be. I think we have to be practical and realistic about this thing and understand people's use of Bitcoin changes with geography, environment, economics. It changes. Yeah. You and I as Westerners living in countries with relatively stable inflation, relatively, I say that cautiously, living in houses with four walls and locked doors and great internet access, we'll have the ability to, or have a different reason for getting Bitcoin and have ability to safely store it. Somebody lives in El Salvador who maybe lives in a one-room shack which doesn't have a lock on its door, or maybe does but is easy to break in, who only operates with a mobile phone, you know, has a very different need and use case for Bitcoin. And I think we need to think about that a bit more, because it is very different. You know, you have to think about security. I could have a Casa multisig wallet and distribute my keys into multiple countries because I fly all the time, right? Somebody El Salvador might never leave the country. So what are they going to do for security? Are they going to have multisig? Also, there's different levels of education. So what are the things that people really need to understand? Well, they need to understand how Bitcoin is different from fiat currencies. They need to understand about volatility and how to manage that. And they need to understand basic security. So I think we have to try and keep this as simple as possible. But people with bad money usually learn about what good money is. It's like, I've been out to Venezuela. People here have five currencies. Like, we don't have a pressing need to understand a better currency. You know, your dollars today will probably buy the same stuff it buys tomorrow, and very similar in the next week and month. The inflation issue we suffer is slow and insidious. If you're in Venezuela, I mean, the two places I've been, I regularly talk about is Venezuela and Cambodia, where people want dollars. If you're in Venezuela, you know the Bolivar is dog shit. So you don't want it. You want the dollar because compared to that, it is a lot better. You have to understand better money and you have to find a way to get access to it. So if for people in El Salvador, they have to understand why Bitcoin is better money, and it's not as obvious to them as it is to people in Venezuela or Argentina or Lebanon right now.
Yeah, it's one thing about it, you know, in our developed nations is I think we have a harder time understanding the use case for it at first. And so it takes like more research, where people in other countries, they hear about it and they see it, and then it kind of clicks of, hey, yeah, this money can't be inflated and taken away. So like when I first heard about Bitcoin, you know, we're talking probably 8-9 years ago, I just viewed it as a stock. And then moving forward, the first time I bought it was for a gambling website because they gave me a higher bonus when I deposited Bitcoin. And then I kind of followed it a little bit after that. But still, I viewed it as part of my diversified portfolio for a few years, that I had, you know, a couple percent of my portfolio into Bitcoin because, again, I thought it was a stock. And then last year was the first time I really was like, all right, let's dive under the hood of what this actually is. You know, I knew the things, and I knew the halving algorithm, I knew the Satoshi story and all that kind of stuff, but I'd never done the research because I didn't need to. My money was more or less fine. And then when they started printing money at this drastic rate, then I was like, okay, I need to do a little bit of research here and actually figure this out. And so it's hard, it's in a way harder for people in like the Western world, whose money is semi-stable, to understand why this is needed, but how powerful sound money can truly be for a society. So like when you're seeing these people in El Salvador and you're, you know, paying over the Lightning Network and paying them in Bitcoin, what is it about that you're seeing? Like, are you seeing that they're excited about it? Are you seeing that they have a willingness to learn and want this change? What are you seeing like on the ground?
It varies. So Enzo, the guy, has a coffee shop in El Zonte and also in El Tunco. He's in. He gets it. He understands Bitcoin and he wants you to pay in Bitcoin, right? Without doubt. There are other places where I've used it. I get the feeling it's like, they don't care. It's like, pay me in dollars, pay me in Bitcoin. I don't care. Just pay me. Just buy some stuff. And I think that's something that El Salvador will see a lot of. There will be people who spend the time understanding, and there'll be people who don't. It's funny, if the first use case again was somewhere like Argentina or certainly Venezuela or even Lebanon, I think it would work much better because they have such shit currencies that Bitcoin makes a lot more sense compared to I don't even know what the currency is in Lebanon, but compared to the those currencies, the dollar isn't that bad. Like, we can sit and hate on it and rag on it and say 40% printed this year, but just generally speaking, if your measure is stability and inflation, the dollar isn't too bad as compared to these other ones. So it's going to be a range of, you're going to have a range of people from those who don't want it at all, don't care about it, to those who will use it because people, they just want to sell something, to those who will take a soft interest, to those who will learn a lot. But hopefully Bitcoin will flood into the El Salvadorian economy. It will continue to rise in value, and that will raise up the purchasing powers of the country. I mean, like, if a whole bunch of, you can just imagine something like 100 million of Bitcoin went into the country, invested in, and Bitcoin does a 10x. That's only $1 billion of value in that country that can start circulating around, which is super cool. So I just think it's going to be, but same here. You know, we have a range of people here. I've got my friends who know I'm a Bitcoin podcaster. They know I travel the world and do it. They know I've got all my net wealth in it, and they've got no interest. They don't care. I bring up Bitcoin, they're like, shut the fuck up, Pete. I don't care. It's like everywhere you go, you've got people who are interested and people who aren't, and people who want to learn and people who don't. And you can't force it onto people, really. People have to want to learn and have to want to do the work and understand it.
Definitely. And like, I mean, I've said it on three straight podcasts now, but Tomer has just a great statement where Tomer Strohlite, and he says, for those with the curiosity to look. And like you just said, those who get curious, they'll start to see the use case. They'll start to see how impactful it can be. And I guess a good question for you would be, you know, you started this podcast 4 years ago. You had prior experience to that with Bitcoin. What was it about Bitcoin itself that said, hey, to like stuck out to you, you know, coming from a stable economy and country, being, hey, like this is the future? How did it really dive into your head, and what made it stand out to you?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I've got to try and be as honest as I can about this. And it's trying to remember, because it's really hard to give you an exact reason. But first of all, I didn't care that much. I was just trading it and making money. I was like, this is cool. Bitcoin's going to be a thing, and I'm going to make a lot of money. So that was the original thing. And then in doing the podcast, I just learned about a lot of different things, like how government money works, how what the negative consequences are of government having free reign to print as much currency as they can, visiting places like Venezuela, Argentina, now El Salvador, seeing people who have a different standard of living or a different currency to work with. Over time, I just think I realized, like, this is such an important technology for the world. You know, a free, open monetary system that anyone can plug into and use. I think that's what it kind of went from being a personal thing to being something for humanity, which sounds hyperbolic, but I mean it, right? If you can have a baseline currency for the world to build a standard on, which removes the ability for governments to print money, I believe that it is a very good foundation for building a better world. So I guess it's gone from a personal thing to a everyone thing. And that's just been by process of doing 360 podcasts and my conviction just changing over time, and I become more entrenched in it rather than just one specific thing where I woke up or something happened. I went, I get it now. That's why Bitcoin matters.
It's funny how, you know, most people, I was the same, came for like the, what do they call it? The number go up technology.
And come for the gains, stay for the freedom.
Yep, exactly. You know, like I was similar. I saw, you know, a potential to make a good amount of money, and I thought that's what it was doing, was trading it and getting, you know, more US dollars in terms, you know, buy some Bitcoin, it goes up and I can sell it into back into fiat in the future. And then, you know, over time, the number goes up, and then so you start getting just more intrigued and you start diving in and doing the research, and you start to realize, like, why would I sell this back to US dollars? Like, this is, I don't need US dollars in the future. Like, this is what it is.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And the one article I send to everyone, anyone who shows any remote interest, I immediately send them to Vijay Boyapati's The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. Because I think most people don't really understand money. They use it, but they've always used it since a kid. So you get your pocket money, you buy some sweets, and then you get your first job, and you just get it and spend it. It's just this natural thing you learn, like language and talking. You just learn it, but you don't really think about it. And then what happens with Bitcoin, you're incentivized to think about it. And then the more you think about it, the more you learn about it, the more you realize that, the more you realize kind of like, it's not just how important the money is, but it's also the secondary effects of having good money. Like, so many things in my life have changed. Like, I'm not a perfect Bitcoiner. So many Bitcoiners out there are, they've got the perfect low time preference, perfect diet, perfect exercise. Like, there's some great Bitcoiners out there who just live a really solid life. And I don't, you know, I'm not financially responsible, but I'm more financially responsible than I was. Like, I haven't completely panned my financial future out, but I'm in a much better position than I was. You know, I don't have a great diet, but it's much better than it was. Like, there's all these secondary effects of thinking about the money and changing your time preference that improve so many aspects of your life. And it sounds, you try and explain that to people, the whole Bitcoin fixes this concept, but it is kind of real. It fixes a lot about your life. You know, it fixes a lot about the world. It can't do everything, but so I'm kind of waffling on again, but I can't remember the original question.
Can you give an example of like how you saw it start to affect your personal life, like as far as your diet or your health? Because that is one thing that's come up on quite a few of my episodes, and it was the same in my personal life, is that it is a common theme that we see in people when they start to, you know, have a sound money in Bitcoin. They really start to understand, or maybe not understand, but they start to like view their life in a different way of, you know, taking care of their body. So what changed in your life when you started diving in?
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of people talking about it, and I'm like, what are they on about? You know, but that, you know, Bitcoin fixes this and fixes diet and fixes everything. But when you start to realize that an abundance of cheap credit leads to a certain lifestyle, certain way of incentivizing people just to keep spend, I could turn around and look at my life and go, look at all the useless shit I've bought, or how I don't care about my diet because there's always something to fix it, you know, pop a pill, whatever. And so I just realized this is, yeah, once I started to get a grip of my finances, I felt like I slowed down in terms of my life. And then when I slowed down, I had time to think about other things like my diet and my health. And I'm still not there. Like, they're not great, but it's a work in progress. There's certainly things I'm working on. So
definitely.
I would say my personal stuff is all a work in progress. I'm just trying to be a better person and live a better life. And I mean, it might not be Bitcoin. It just might be my age as well. I'm 42, and you know, I have to think about these things, right? You know, I have to think about how many years am I going to get left, and what decisions are going to make sure I have more of them than less than them. And so maybe it isn't just Bitcoin that does that, but Bitcoin's definitely had an influence on me. And that might be, again, it might be something else. It might be because I'm surrounded by a group of people who think differently, or who do expand beyond just the money and talk about lifestyle things, which I know I should be doing. So I can't give you a hard thing, but all I know is since I've been in Bitcoin, I've lived a better life in terms of health. And like, I used to be really fat, yeah, and I'm still overweight, but I'm nothing like I was. So yeah, so I mean, the other thing you throw in is like, life's pretty good at the moment. So there's an incentive to live as long as possible, because I like living. I want to do as much of it as I can.
Exactly. It was like, that you say that, it makes me think of something funny. It was like, I, like, when I was, you know, younger, I would have no problem saying, yeah, like, I'd be fine dying young. you know, dying at 45 or 50. I've lived a good life and I don't really want to be old and decrepit and like that kind of stuff, as you know, as long as, you know, I'm happy. And, but like now, the more I think about it, it's like, hey, like I've got sound money and a future that I want to, explore and live through and enjoy that, you know, as long as possible with the people around me, with my friends, my family, my girlfriend, you know, all those people. And it's like, hey, like, let's run this out as long as possible. I don't know if that's the same sentiment for me anymore. And now with sound money, I'm 27.
Oh, you're a baby. Fucking hell. 27. Oh man. I miss being in my 20s. Yeah. I mean, you saying that makes me think of something else. I'm a lot more comfortable with death now than I was, because I wasn't like that. I wanted to be really old because I wanted to delay the finding out of what death is, because you either find out it's something or you don't find out anything out, right? You don't find out it's nothing, because if it's nothing, you just don't find out. You just die and that's it. That's it. It's done. Game over. The powers come out of the socket, never to play again. You're done. Or there's something else. Now, I do see your necklace, so I know you have faith or something else. But you don't know. None of us actually know. We just have faith and beliefs, right? But I'm quite comfortable now with death. I mean, I don't want to die at 42. I don't want to die at 52. Sometimes I think about, what's the lowest I would take if I was offered it now? Like if someone turned around and said, Pete, you can take, we're going to offer you 72, or you roll the dice and see where you get. I'll be like, okay, let me think about that, because I've done a lot of fucking drugs, drunk a lot. I've not been the healthiest. I don't know. I could be one of those guys who dies at 58. 72 gives me another 14 years. Or, you know, you roll the dice and you get 80 something. I think about that a lot, but I'm actually quite comfortable with it all now, because I feel like I've really lived my life. Like I've gone for it. I've done everything I can to try and have as many experiences as I can. And I'm quite happy with what I've done. So yeah. But anyway, that said, you got to give yourself the best opportunity. You got to sleep well, eat well, drink well, look after your body. You got to look after your mind. And I'm a lot more conscious of that these days, but I don't want to say yes. I bought Bitcoin and suddenly everything changed. There's multiple things happening.
Couldn't agree more. One thing you just touched on was like looking after your mind. Do you meditate?
I used to. Yeah, I haven't for a long time. I need to get back into it. I had to do it because I haven't, after the breakup of my marriage and trying to recover from drug addiction, I had crippling anxiety and panic attacks. But my panic attacks were so bad, I used to have this thing called an SVT, where basically my heart rate would go up to about 200 beats per minute. I'll tell you what it is. So an SVT is a supraventricular tachycardia. So basically, it's a condition where your heart suddenly beats much faster than normal. It's not usually serious, but some may need treatment. The bad thing about it is that every symptom is the same as a heart attack, right? So it happens. And so when I had my first one, that's when I was doing drugs. I was convinced I was having a heart attack, and I had to call an ambulance. Clammy hands, felt dizzy, pains in my chest, heart going mental. I was like, I'm having a heart attack. Fuck, you idiot. You did all these drugs and now you're going to die. It's over. You dickhead. Got in the ambulance and found out it was an SVT. And I've had four or five of them. I've only had one in the last 3 or 4 years, but I used to have these panic attacks, the anxiety and the SVTs. So I had to use meditation to get out of it, because I'd come off the drugs and it was just crippling. There'll be some days where it just towards the end of the day, maybe I feel a bit anxious. There'll be some days where I'd wake up and feel anxious and it would be with me all day. And it sucked. So the only way I could deal with it is I used to do three things. I used to go running, and I would go out and run 5-10 miles. I would do yoga and I would meditate. And meditation was really a medicine for an incoming panic attack. So when I felt it would come in, I'd go and sit at the end of my bed and I'd meditate. And it took a while. But after some time, I managed to sometimes hit that sweet spot where you genuinely clear your mind. I wouldn't say I went into a trance, but I certainly got to that point where I was just, all the shit was gone. And I could just, you know, maybe do 20, 30 minutes without realizing I'd done 20, 30 minutes. And yes, you saying it now is making me think, you fucking idiot, you need to get back into that. Because it was great. I loved it. You know, I could go from a point of absolute panic and fear, thinking the whole world is closing in on me, to 10, 20 minutes later, just feeling amazing. And you know what? Ever since I've got, you know, the anxiety's gone, the panic attacks are gone, the SVTs are gone, I've stopped doing it. So I probably should get back into it.
It's wild how powerful our brains are. I've tried to be more active about it the last couple months. And I was just like sitting there thinking, like the first time, like I was in the middle of it, and it was the first time in my life, like I had felt like I'd actually been able to truly like meditate, you know, clear my brain enough to, you know, get in the zone and follow something and do it. And I remember thinking back, because I tried it a couple of times in college and just could never, my brain was just running. And I was like, this is dumb. I'm, you know, like, what am I doing? And I would just get up and go do something else. And I remember sitting there thinking, it was the very first time I did it. And I was like, man, if I could have just like got myself to do this when I was younger, like how much it would have improved my life, like in sense of, you know, more focused and more intentional around things you're doing and actions you're taking. And, you know, like with basketball, how much it would have just like helped me to slow down and process and feel the game differently in sports. And I just remember having like the moment of clarity. I was like, yeah, I should probably be doing this every day. And for the past, you know, couple months, I think I've done it 85-90% of the days. And just like,
wow.
I notice it helps me so tremendously. And like, it's just wild, like how strong our brains are if we're, you know, putting the right things in, how we can really start to get the right things out. Like, you know, I had 5 extra minutes or so before our show. And I just sat there and tried to like, you know, focus on my breathing and just like relax my heart rate. And I was like, okay, I'm thinking clear now. I'm woken up. It's, you know, morning. I had my breakfast, and let's get on with the show. And nice. It's pretty funny.
Is there a pattern to your meditation? Like, do you try and do it in the morning, at night, or anything?
That's what I'm trying to do right now. That's what I'm trying to work on, is make it a pattern and make it a habit. So there's one on Headspace on Netflix that I've been going through. They've got like 8 or 9 different episodes, and you can kind of pick a different like theme for the ones that, like, for what you're feeling at the time. So I try and do those before bed, and then my goal is to do Wim Hof breathing in the mornings. So my goal, when I can get to the point of where I wake up, do 10 or 11 minutes of Wim Hof breathing, and then go down to the gym, and then at night, right before I go to bed, do some Headspace meditation. That is when I know I'll like be in the spot I want to be, because I've done it a handful of times where it's like that cycle on both sides of my day. And I just like, I feel great. I sleep great. I wake up energized. I feel like I have a great day in the gym and at work and on podcasts and recording. And it's like, okay, that's what I need to be doing. And we know what we need to do. We just have to like execute.
Dude, that Wim Hof stuff is incredible. I get the alerts every day, and I don't always get around to doing it, but I do try. Have you timed how long you can hold your breath?
I think I got up to about 3 minutes.
Okay. So I'd never broken 3 minutes, because I do this weird thing where I go to the swimming pool and with my kids, and I'll just have a couple of goes at how long I can hold my breath underwater. And I'd regularly get to 2-2.5 minutes, but never like beyond that. I got to 3:05 on the Wim Hof thing. And I've not beaten that, but I think I've got 4 minutes in me.
That'd be very impressive. Like I was very proud of myself for getting the 3. And like, granted, I wasn't underwater.
3 is incredible.
I wasn't underwater, so I don't know if like I actually was, but it felt like it to me. But it is crazy. Like I was doing it with like a couple of my coworkers the other day. Like we were just watching videos late at night, and I was like, "Have you guys ever done Wim Hof meditation?" And some of them were like, "No." And then so I threw on a video, and we all tried it out. And one, we all just like really got a lot out of it. We felt like mentally we were like tuned in and focused. But two, it's crazy. You're sitting there and you're holding your breath, and you can truly like start to feel like your heartbeat and your blood flowing like in between the beats. And you're like just so in touch with your body and feel so incredibly relaxed. And then you come out of it, your mind is just like sharp and dialed in, and you're just like thinking clearly. It's like, man, if I could have like learned this when I was young and had this be a habit my whole life, like I just feel like that stuff is so powerful. What was that?
The thing is when you're young, you're like, life's too exciting. There's loads of shit you want to do. You have to go through a maturity for it. So you have to be ready. I mean, I think at 27, that's pretty cool that you're doing it.
Have you tried to do it with your son or your kids?
Not yet. No, not yet. One thing I will say, just on the breathing thing, a good way to do it is get your girlfriend and just fill up the bath, get in it, and then do it with your head underwater, because it's different underwater. Because you can't cheat in any way at all. You don't know if air's coming in or not. But the way to do it is have her with you, have her time it, and then have her every 15 seconds just tap you on the shoulder. That's the way I do it, because I don't have a clock, but I need to know my progress. I need to know what I'm working towards. I don't want to randomly just come out of the water. So I always have that. I just have a little tap. And I usually find minute two is easier than minute one. And then minute three, usually the first 15, 20 seconds are okay. And then up to the third minute, it's tough. I also find if you do it, you usually get three goes, and your third is usually your best. Because your first one, you're just opening up the lungs. The second, same again. Then the third one, you can really go for it. But after that one, there's like diminishing returns. Apparently we can all train ourselves up to, it's possible in all of us to get to like 4 or 5 minutes.
It's wild. So when you do it, do you do the breathing, and then when you hold, you duck your head under the water? Is that what you do?
So no, the Wim Hof thing, I just do that sat on the couch. I do a slightly different thing when I'm in like a swim pool. I did it out in El Salvador. I was there with Miles and Dylan and a few other people. I was like, I can do this weird thing where I can hold my breath underwater for a long time. I can do 3 minutes. So they were all betting on me. And I did 256 with them there. I was so close to three and I just didn't make it. I don't know why, because four seconds at 2 minutes 56, 4 seconds feels a long time. But I got to my limit, and then I tried again after that, and I think I didn't even get over like 2 minutes. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those weird things. I like practicing. It feels like an interesting thing. I worry one day I might go too far and like knock myself, because you can faint. Yeah, you can faint from it, or it's probably called something else. Yeah,
it is interesting though. You know, push your body and just you feel better. But yeah, it's funny how, like, at the end of the day, you start just taking, like, we got on this rabbit trail from, you know, Bitcoin, you know, fixing our bodies and just getting us into meditation. It's just wild how many different things kind of has a finger in. Like you said earlier, like your friends who, you know, aren't in the space, your buddies, you know, back home, it's like, they look at you like you're crazy when you talk about, oh yeah, I'm exercising more and all this stuff.
Do you do only guided meditations, or do you do your own silent meditations?
Currently still only guided meditations. I don't feel like I'm have a good enough grasp on it yet to do my own.
Yeah, because there's an interesting difference. So there's another app called Calm, and I used to use that app when I was suffering from anxiety. So they have like emergency meditations for anxiety. They were great because someone would talk to you and calm you down. But I also, a lot of the time, was trying to practice my own one silently. It's hard, man. You're like, I'm so bored. You try not to think of anything. And then you're like, I need to go and get some eggs from the shop. Fuck, shut up. I think Jurgen Klopp should be picking a different right back this weekend for Arsenal. What am I thinking? You're like, a few times I've genuinely gone into a complete, like, nothing for minutes on end. And it is like a trance, but I was doing it all year, and I didn't do it regularly. But it's like anything, podcasting, playing basketball, anything you work at, you will get better at if you keep trying.
Yep. We should do a challenge. I think you said you want to get back into it. Next 30 days, we should both try and meditate every single day and see if we can get there.
What time of the day do you think? If I have a consistent time of the day, I'll try and do it. So maybe if I put a diary reminder in there.
I see. For me personally, I find if I do it either right when I wake up or right before I go to bed is when I'm best, most consistent. Probably before bed for me, because that's like the weekends and stuff. I wake up at different hours and have different things going on. But yeah, well, I think
it helps you to get some sleep, especially if you're like, I don't know, do you ever have insomnia, like just can't get to sleep?
Very, very rarely. So pretty much never. I'm lucky to be a pretty good sleeper.
Yeah, I used to have it a lot. I used to have like this inability to get to sleep. I don't these days, because usually I'll just stick on a podcast with a 10-minute timer, and I very rarely does the timer beat me. Usually I'm asleep within that 10 minutes. Meditating as a way to go to sleep, because I like, when I used to meditate, I used to do the sitting up meditation. So to do that at bedtime, you've got to lay down. I don't know if that's really a meditation or you're just training yourself to fall asleep.
Yeah, I want to know either. Okay, Peter, like, really appreciate your time. I got two final questions for you today.
Shoot, brother.
Okay, you were using Bitcoin to buy drugs on the Silk Road. Do you have any crazy Silk Road stories, or thinking, you know, you were going to get arrested, anything like that that came from that back in the day?
No, I mean, it's not a time in my life I'm proud of anymore. And I tell you why, because I'm very honest about it. I don't hide anything, but I picked up my son from school one day and he was like, "Dad, can I ask you something?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "It's a bit weird." I was like, "What's that?" He said, "Oh, I was Googling you. I found an interview where you said you had a drug addiction." I was like, "Oh, okay. All right, well, we need to talk about that." And so I had to sit him down and explain it to him. And it's cool and he gets it. And yeah, he's a good kid. But I was just kind of like, "Oh, it's a bit ashamed about that." So any kind of stories I would tell you would just cover more of the stuff that's kind of shameful and he would hear, like the kind of states I got myself in, like really bad. I go into a really bad place one, but like drugs can be great fun. People have to accept that. That's why people do them. They have a lot of fun, but then they can stop being fun and it's awful. And so I look back at that time. I don't regret anything because it's all part of everything I've been through, but I also don't, I'm also conscious of how much I put out there with it, because I don't want my, I'd rather they hear it from me first, if you know what I mean. No, it's fine. You don't have to shake that. This is cool. What I'm saying is, it's like the most interesting stories are probably the most shameful ones, but they're the ones that shaped a lot about where I've been. So yeah, I tell you the most interesting Silk Road story is, for me, in some ways, it's the thing that introduces me to Bitcoin. And then 7-8 years after that happens, I'm sharing letters back and forth with Ross Ulbricht, the creator. You know, at the time when I first discovered this website, this anonymously run marketplace, it doesn't cross my mind that in a few years' time, I'm going to have a podcast and interview the creator's mother and then write to him in prison. He's going to write back to me. And you know, we've written to each other a couple of times. That's probably the most interesting thing, is that all these things kind of connected with each other, all these dots connected.
Yeah, hearing his recorded speech at the Bitcoin conference was very powerful. You know, just listening to the words that he had to say, and I mean, it's sad.
It was depressing.
It was. And he had some powerful things to say. And at the end of the day, like, he did something wrong and he knows that. But what he's put up with since then, and, you know, them putting him in jail for longer than killers, and what does he have, like 80 years or something like that? Yeah.
It's a double life sentence plus 40 years.
Yeah. And for, you know, he built a website, and then the shady things that happened around, you know, there were the supposed, you know, allegations of using a hitman, but then they waited until after the trial to drop those charges. Just everything surrounding the situation was very shady. And it's sad that a man's life is going to be, you know, at this point stolen, you know, for for the future, foreseeable future. Hopefully somebody one day can, you know, make it right and exonerate him. But at this point, it's very sad to see. And
it's just waste. It's just a waste of someone's life.
And he's a very bright human being as well. It's like you hear that and when he speaks, and obviously the ideas and, you know, the execution, the way he was able to do it, it shows like he is an intelligent man. So, you know, hopefully one day that can be set right. It's definitely a little sad for sure. And final question, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, it's just a waste of a life. It's sad. It makes me feel really sad. And I was sat with his mum, Lynn, just two seats down from her when it came on. And it wasn't what I expected, because I thought we might hear him talk about how great Bitcoin is and things like that as well. I thought I was expecting maybe an interview, but really it was just how terribly sad and tough it is what he was going through. And I just felt very empty after it. Sad and, you know, obviously a bit upset by it. So fingers crossed we will have a president at some point in the future who will release him from that system.
Definitely agree. Final question in a little better note. So if you had 2 hours, you know, sit down at dinner with somebody dead or alive, and you could explain to them, you know, like what Bitcoin one means to you and what it can mean to the world and humanity, who would that be and why?
Oh, that's a great question. That's one of those ones in some ways I would almost want to think about it more. But actually, the answer is quite simple. Just because I did an interview with Princey the other day, and I was talking about my mum. I don't know if you heard it. And I got a bit emotional because obviously my mum died a few years ago, and it's just shit, really, losing a parent. And what I was saying to Princey is, like, you know, I've been so lucky this last 4 years with what's happened with my life that I kind of forget it all happened after my mum. And it kind of happened because of her. It's because we wanted to get her a treatment, and the only way we could do that is with Bitcoin. And then she died, and I'm sat around. I've still got that bit of Bitcoin. I go on Coinbase, see Ethereum, I end up buying some stuff and creating a podcast. So, yeah, which has allowed me to travel the world, do amazing things, make money and interview presidents, like this most unbelievable life that I never thought I would be able to have. So actually, it sounds a little bit cliche, but I kind of like my mum back here to just, because she's missed all this. And as I said to Princey, she wouldn't care too much. I could have just done some really nice things for her. You know, I could have taken her to a nice restaurant, took her shopping, bought her a handbag or something, stuff she didn't care about, but I could have done stuff like that. So I'd like to sit down. I'd love to have my mum here and just tell her what it meant for me, which is not really about Bitcoin. It's what the secondary effects of discovering Bitcoin are, is to live this just such fortunate life. She liked to travel, and I've been to like 25, 30 countries with this job, and I've got to meet the most amazing people. I get to pick my hours, so I can take my kids to school, pick them up. I get to talk to you right now and have this amazing conversation. I just get to do so many lucky things, and I'd like to tell her about that. And I mean, she wouldn't really care that much, but she'd be like, okay, that's interesting. She'd be proud. And then to tell her what it kind of means for the world. My mum's like you. She's religious. She's a Christian. She was strong, strong faith. And she worked for a charity that was part of the church called St. Vincent de Paul. And I think they're a global Christian charity. St. Vincent de Paul, yeah. But what they did in Bedford, where I live, is they used to get furniture and help people who didn't have much money, maybe get them a couch or a bed or whatever into their house. And that was her thing. So she used to be part of that and help that. And yeah, she had a heart that cared about other people. And she worked for the NHS. She was a nurse, you know. And I'd like to tell her about how Bitcoin is maybe changing the lives of people in El Salvador, and then how that is something that can happen around the world. So it's a little bit like, oh, the obvious answer, your dead parent, but it kind of is. It'd be my mom. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think it sounds like your mom was a pretty incredible woman and strong woman. And I see a lot of
she
similarities.
Was unique. She was unique.
Oh, I mean, if she raised you, she had to have been pretty unique, right?
Dude, honestly, I'm nothing like my dad. My dad's an introvert. I'm nothing like my brother or sister. I'm a bit like my mum, but my mum was unique in a different way. Like, my mum didn't have a filter. So if it came in her head, she would say it. And she would... Like, I'll tell you a funny story my dad told me. My mum and dad are on a cruise, right? And they've made friends with this couple. And the lady's quite big. She's quite a big lady. And she's telling my mum that she's been on a diet. And she's like, oh, yeah, I've lost a lot of weight. I've been on this diet for 6 months. And my mum turns around and went, well, how bloody big were you? Like, I know what she's thinking, but like, she didn't think it through. And my dad was like, oh, my God, it was so embarrassing. But you loved her for it. Like, everyone loved my mum. She'd say the most embarrassing shit. But she was pretty cool. So yeah, I miss her a lot. Her name was Maureen. She was to have another 2 hours with her. Because God, I'm doing this thing where I waffle on. One of the weird things about losing anyone is they die, and you're terribly upset, and then that day is awful, and the next day is pretty awful, and the next week's pretty awful. But you eventually get to a point where then you forget about them for a period. You know, it might be a week you haven't thought about it. It's like, fuck, I haven't thought about my mum for a week. And also your memories of them are distant. I remember that time with my mum, but I don't remember exactly. Like, this conversation in an hour, I'll remember you exactly, right? I'll remember you've got a necklace with a cross, or maybe you've got a moustache, you like basketball. I'll be very clear. You ask me about this interview in a month, I'll be like, ah, oh, yeah, that's that Eric guy. He liked basketball. And then in a year, I'll be like, maybe I can't remember it. And that's, you know, that's even with a parent, there's lots of things I don't remember anymore. So to have a couple more hours with her, I'd probably try and cover Bitcoin in 5 minutes and talk about some other stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's powerful. And, you know, it sounds like she was an awesome woman and, you know, looking down over you, proud of you now. And, you know, it sounds like, reminds me a lot of my mother. You know, my mom has a little bit more of a filter, but very strong woman, cares so much about everybody, makes friends with everybody. She was also a nurse. So a lot of similarities there. But Peter, thank you so much for your time today. Really enjoyed our conversation. You know, we touched Bitcoin for a few minutes, but just talking about life and enjoying the conversation was a great time for me. Tell the listeners where they can find you at, and I'll have everything in the show notes.
Great. Yeah. I mean, my podcast is called What Bitcoin Did. So you Google What Bitcoin Did, you're going to find it. It's Spotify, Apple, Google, it's everywhere. And I'm on Twitter. My handle is my name, at Peter McCormack. DMs aren't open anymore, sorry. But if you want to reach out to me, you can probably find my email address somewhere. I do try and reply to everyone. And yeah, keep learning about Bitcoin, keep stacking sats, and try and be kind to people.
Wonderful. Thanks, Peter. Like I said, I'll have all that in the show notes in the bio. You can find Peter there. Reach out to him if you need. He's a great resource, and he has a tremendous amount of episodes and knowledge that's been, you know, shared through guests and through himself from his previous recordings. So he's a great, great resource for the Bitcoin community. So thanks again, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate that.
Like I mentioned at the beginning, this was such a fun conversation with Peter. I really enjoyed just chatting about life, Bitcoin, and everything in between. Thank you for tuning in once again, and if this is your first episode you've heard, thank you for joining, and please go check out some of the others. I've had some incredible guests on previously that share a tremendous amount of knowledge. I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating if you think I deserve it, as well as a subscription and review on Apple Pods if you'd be so generous. If you have any questions or want to reach out, you can find me at E3BTC on all social or E3BTC.com. Take a peek at the show notes. There are links to everything mentioned as always. Thanks again, and we will catch you soon. Take us away, bro.